Okay, Mr. Rosenthal.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. This court set forth the definitive test for evaluating FCA complaints in Grubbs v. Conaganti. That test has become the leading case for the majority view in a circuit split on how FCA complaints should be evaluated. The Grubbs test maintains a delicate balance between three competing considerations. It recognizes that Rule 8 requires notice pleading in a short and plain statement of the claims, that Rule 9b is a flexible and context-specific requirement that requires that particular details of fraud be alleged, and that the FCA is a broad remedial statute whose purpose is to remedy frauds against the public fisc. The complaint here meets the Grubbs standard in spades. The first aspect of the Grubbs standard is that the complaint must plead particular details of the fraudulent scheme, and the complaint does so here. The relator offers an insider perspective as a former sales manager at the defendant, and he supports his allegations with internal communications and emails that are contemporaneous from the defendant. These allegations show that the defendant targeted high potential referrers with large government payer patient bases, targeted providers with large government payer patient bases, particularly VA patients with TRICARE. That they provided numerous benefits to these providers, including tens of thousands of dollars in cash, trips to places like Las Vegas, meals at fancy restaurants, free administrative labor, and most egregiously, an annuity system whereby they greased the wheels for private payer patients to become customers of Senseonics and set up these patients as annuities for the doctors because the patients would have to keep coming back every 3 months for another procedure to reinsert a new sensor into their arms.
There's a serious question, though, whether you've adequately alleged scienter in this case. Can you show us where you did?
Yes. If you look at paragraph 70 of the complaint, that's probably the most obvious place. In paragraph 70 of the complaint, there is a reference to a program within Senseonics and a presentation that was given to sales associates at Senseonics. And it mentions, and this is a quote from the presentation that was given by Senseonics, "We cannot reimburse a healthcare provider that has the ability to prescribe, influence, or direct a patient to Eversense. This would be considered inducement and a violation of the anti-kickback statute." So Senseonics recognized that the anti-kickback statute prohibits giving remuneration in exchange for inducements. And of course they recognize this because the anti-kickback statute is a fundamental statute within our healthcare regulatory regime. We're not talking about an obscure regulation. We're talking about something that is a criminal offense to give inducements and something that virtually everyone in this space understands. We also see that when it comes to the various sham programs that Senseonics put in place to get private payer patients into as annuities for doctors, which provides a benefit to doctors because those patients become annuities, it limited it to private payer patients. You know, they thought this would, you know, keep them out of the restrictions of the anti-kickback statute, but the fact that they even drew that distinction at all shows that they were aware of the problems with providing remuneration in exchange for federal referrals. And the rest of the evidence shows that they clearly intended to induce referrals of government payer patients, especially VA patients, through their providing of inducements.
Even with a slightly relaxed Grubbs test, do you list or describe any particular kickback where money was given to a doctor?
Sure.
What's the most particularized? Because words like annuity, I mean, I'm sure they'll stand up and say that's just descriptive. In other words, of course, if a patient needs this type of glucose monitoring device, they got to go back again and again. So calling it annuity is just a sort of syntactical move. They're not locked in just because they just simply have to go back to the doctor to put the sensor in.
Well, these pull-through schemes in which private payer patients are put into a pipeline to benefit doctors in exchange for federal referrals are common, but there's other types of remuneration that are provided. For example, paragraph 73 says that one provider, Dr. B, was paid more than $20,700 in 2019, including more than $2,000 in travel and lodging.
Sending doctors to speaker engagements, whether we like it or not, is not fraudulent.
Well, it can be, but if one of the purposes is to induce federal referrals under this court's one-purpose test that's been adopted in circuit courts across the country, it still is illegal. The fact that there may also be a legitimate purpose, and we would dispute whether there is even here, but it's irrelevant to the question, because as long as one purpose of the referrals, or of the payment of the remuneration, was to induce referrals, then it violates the anti-kickback statute. We also see that other doctors were paid.
Just even reduce it more simply. Specifically, as a salesman, the relator was doing what? He had a device that's approved by the FDA, mm-hmm. and he's encouraging patients and doctors to use their device. That's just legitimate. Of course, you're going to promote your product.
Yes.
So when you say, where does it slip into fraud?
It slips into fraud when we see that the...
But B is factually, instead of sham and annuity, tell me exactly where the fraud happens.
One good example is we see that in the internal communications, they are monitoring the requisitions of the doctors who they're paying. We see specific emails in which managers at Senseonics are saying that this particular provider's requisitions are down. We need to get her re-engaged again, or him re-engaged again.
Right, but isn't that just what you do? The doctor's just, you know, he must be using somebody else's product. Let's get the salesman in to talk, find out what's wrong with our product.
They didn't just get the salesman in to talk. The way they got him re-engaged is they took them to dinner at fancy steakhouses. In fact, they say, and Mr. Ramirez, one of Mr. Carew's managers, says that a particular provider's requisitions are down, let's take her to dinner and get her re-engaged again.
When you say requisitions are down, you mean they're just not using the product enough?
They're not ordering that the product be used enough.
Okay. So you'd be concerned. If you believe in your product, you'd want to go say, why aren't you, you know, and I thought the primary basis for the inference of fraud was that the CPT code jumps up for these three doctors.
That is one of the primary bases. There are several. Certainly, well,
tell me what your most specific, the biggest aggravator, indicator of fraud is. I thought that was it.
What? Well, there's many of them.
I know you're going to say many, but just to simplify a case for me, tell me the most egregious that isn't aggressive marketing. It's fraud. It's money for something a patient doesn't need. Do you have that?
I'd say the most egregious indicator of fraud is that they're especially monitoring the requisitions of these providers, and when they find that the provider's requisitions are down, mm-hmm. they provide additional remuneration and benefits in order to get those requisitions back up. That is a textbook example of providing remuneration as in order to induce referrals.
And what's your best example in the FCA context? That seeing that a doctor's not using your product, going to him and saying, can we talk about it? Let's go to dinner. You're going to come speak at our conference. What's an example of any case that says that's fraud?
Well, there's several.
Your best case.
I would say some of the cases that are similar.
No, just the best one, because everyone knows that's the question I ask. What's your strongest case?
Well, I would point you to a few of them. Okay. Within this circuit, I would point you to Marlin Medical, which is in the Western District of Texas. Okay. I would also point you to Parikh.
Okay, that's fine.
In other circuits, in the Northern District of California has a couple of really good cases, one called Vibrant and one called Crescendo, that are very
similar. These are in your brief?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. That's all I need to know.
The second aspect of the Grubbs test requires reliable indicia of claims, and we have, again, abundant allegations of reliable indicia of claims. Not only do we have the messages about monitoring the requisitions, and we also have internal documents advising that they target doctors with heavy VA patient loads, looking at insulin bill reports for VA patients, and saying that hundreds of patients are from the VA are already using these products. We also have Medicare claims data. Now, the Medicare claims data are for services that would be associated with a device like Senseonics device. And we see that after these providers who were targeted were provided with remuneration, their use of these billing codes skyrocketed.
This is 92521.
There's two different billing codes.
But aren't they both generalized? They're not specific to you.
That's correct. But at the time, we also have allegations in the complaint that Senseonics was marketing their product as the world's only long-term CGM product. So the allegations are that at the time, this was the only long-term CGM. And so these billing codes, which are associated with long-term CGMs and monitoring them and installing them, it's certainly plausible to infer that those are related to this product. It also...
Where's the fraud?
I'm sorry?
Where is the fraud for the United States government, the government funds?
The fraud is in the implied representation that claims that are submitted are not tainted by kickbacks.
Mm-hmm. The underlying product itself, does it not do what it's supposed to do?
No, but that is not a relevant consideration under the anti-kickback statute. The question of medical necessity.
I want to ask you a factual question. What in the record shows that there's any failure of the actual product itself? It's an illegitimate product. It doesn't do the job.
There isn't any evidence of that or any allegations.
It's just a promotion of a product which has a medical benefit. But you said your argument is that the government was cheated because you promoted the product so much that in turn, of course, that came out of the federal treasury.
That's right. I think the policy behind the anti-kickback statute is that remuneration and compensation to medical providers clouds medical judgment and therefore has a corrosive impact on the entire system. And so whether or not a service or product is medically necessary or beneficial to the patient is not the question in a kickback case. The question is whether the defendant intentionally offered inducements, remuneration, in order to induce providers to prescribe the device or the service, because that corrodes the medical judgment. And as a person who goes to a doctor, I think we'd all like to know if our doctor had received tens of thousands of dollars in trips to Las Vegas and other benefits for the products and services that they were recommending that we use.
Most top doctors are taken on these extraordinary trips. You're saying all of that is fraud?
Well, it's not all fraud, but in this case it is. And the evidence shows that the intent of providing this remuneration was to induce the doctors to make these referrals, and that is exactly what the anti-kickback statute prohibits. There may be other cases in which that evidence doesn't exist, in other cases in which these speakers are targeted because of their,
You filed your quitam action, you followed the statute, you sent the a copy of your complaint to the government, and what was the reply of the government?
The government did its investigation. We had little insight into that. They asked for some extensions, and this was filed during the COVID pandemic, so there were some obstacles to the investigation at the time. Ultimately, the government declined, but that is part of the statutory design of the False Claims Act, that relators are able to move forward with the claims. I would mention that the False Claims Act does contain a nearly unfettered right of the government to dismiss the claims if it finds them to lack merit or for any other legitimate purpose, and the government never did so here. I only have a few more minutes. I'd like to reserve some time, but I would like to close by saying that the district court here recognized that the allegations were certainly plausible, troubling, and implicated potential ethical issues.
Well, let me again, one thing of public knowledge is that the incredible amounts of money, millions of dollars, that are which the government is directly being defrauded by people who are setting up and simply filling out the paperwork, and for false people, getting hold of just the Social Security number and a name, and they're typing it in, and it's automatically paid by the United States government. And maybe that's where their focus is. But you're talking about a product that troubles me about your case, is that you're talking about just promotion of a product, urging people to do a product which you're not saying is not provide a medical benefit.
Well, if it's the medical benefit alone that would sell the product, and if simply information about the product and its benefit to customers were all that was needed to persuade doctors that use it, then we wouldn't have a case. But unfortunately, what we see...
It's coming down solely to the fact that my experience in these cases with the medical profession and the people who are selling the doctors and promoting their products, it's a heavy inducement. that if that, go back to what the earlier suggestion of my colleague to follow up on that. The representative drug representative, the reps that go into these doctors' offices, they're there to promote the use of drugs or medicines that they sell, and to push them to do that. But at what point does that's which is almost a universal practice, and at what point does that become actionable as a quick time action, given your approach to this, the promotion of a legitimate drug?
It becomes actionable when there's evidence that shows that the defendant intended to induce referrals by providing benefits, something of value, to the provider in exchange for the referrals.
That sole notion that the that so that if the frequently they do come with cookies and little flavors for the people who are working under the doctors, they're cozy up to them, and they also keep medical records of the gender of these the medical professions, and they match the genders so that it's et cetera, et cetera. So, all these sales techniques, that's my difficulty with it. I understand your pursuit of this, but how that sorts out in the reality of what's going on out there.
Well, Your Honor, at some point the benefit may be de minimis to the point where no reasonable person could plausibly conclude that the benefit would actually induce the referral. But when it's tens of thousands of dollars, trips to Las Vegas, fancy dinners, annuity streams, and it's specifically in black and white for the purpose of getting requisitions back up and re-engaging the doctor, then it's a very different case. If there are no further questions, I don't know if I've reserved any time, but.
Yes, you've saved time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Richter?
John Richter on behalf of Senseonics. May it please the court. There is nothing inherently suspicious about a medical device company with a brand new product that is just being introduced to the marketplace, engaging key opinion leaders, experienced physicians, to speak about the product, to educate, to raise awareness through marketing, to introduce a new device and ensure that it is used safely and effectively. Companies like Senseonics routinely engage physicians to speak and routinely market to those doctors whom they believe may treat patients for whom the device is intended.
And no matter how generous the trip, let's say it's, you know, to the Sicilies, Club Med, we're talking, you know, let's exaggerate it a little, not just Las Vegas. Sure. And at no point would it become actionable, provided they're just promoting an approved device, no matter how generous the company is to the
Well, device. That gets at the rub of why the amended complaint here is so deficient, is that none of the details that this court sees and recognizes in other cases about speaker arrangements that are found to give rise to the kinds of inferences that convert an otherwise lawful speaking engagement to something plausibly not are alleged here. So notwithstanding the rhetoric of the argument, the amended complaint doesn't actually put any facts and meat on the bone as it relates to the speaker arrangements. There are no terms and conditions that are discussed about why Dr. B or Dr. W were engaged. There are the bare outlines in three paragraphs of this complaint that simply 65, 75, and 84 that simply describe only after the fact internal discussions between some sales reps who note that the two doctors spoke. And these are emails and communications in the early part of 2019.
When I pressed, he drew comparison to Marlin Medical. Do you know that case?
I do. And both the Marlin Medical case and the Parikh case, district court cases that Relators Counsel mentioned, both of them have very substantive allegations. Now, they're very different facts and circumstances than we have here. They're not about a medical device company. The Marlin Medical is about a compounding company that had an alleged scheme to pay doctors to come and speak at an event to patients directly and then actually sit down with the patients and engage with them and prescribe them the compounded drug that Marlin Medical had and was seeking to promote. They likewise had allegations in the Marlin Medical case about payment arrangements that raised questions about why, how, and what this was all about, given that they were making payments to and offers to invest in the doctors' companies as opposed to actually paying them for the fair market value of legitimate educational services and speaking engagements.
Opposing counsel did say the district court was troubled, particularly by what they're calling the annuity lock-in scheme. Do you want to speak to that? I think that's more patient-focused, correct?
Completely patient-focused. There is no connection. First of all, there's no connection in this amended complaint between these three doctors and any of the other allegations that relate to the marketing. They ask us to speculate that somehow these doctors may have been part of that, but it's nowhere connected in the amended complaint. So when we look at these, the point that you made, Judge Higginson, as to the simple reality that it's diabetes, it's a chronic condition, you're going to have to go back to the doctor. The context in which that has happened, when you look at the allegations in the complaint, is there's sales reps who are sitting there in 2019 when the device is not covered by CMS, and they are asking, gosh, how can we get a doctor to possibly prescribe this, since patients are going to have to come out of pocket themselves to pay for the device themselves, as opposed to Medicare patients who would be covered for other continuous glucose monitoring devices, which the generalized codes acknowledge are already in existence. And so those patient marketing programs, first of all we have are emails that suggest they're talking about it. There are no particularized details that even say it happened. They don't identify a single doctor who they ever went and talked to about these things. They never identify a single patient who ever participated in this. So the kinds of allegations are in fact consistent with a pre-approval, a time when most insurers are not covering the device, including Medicare, and they're talking about how can we, you know, engage with doctors, convince doctors to potentially find a way to get over the hump, that the reality is they've got a big financial burden that a patient will have to bear until such time as coverage is extended to the device, which does not happen. It's uncontroverted.
Is there any evidence of alleged, or I should say any evidence of, is there any allegation of that, in fact, the result of this practices that the accused practice here is that their patients that don't need the product are using or buying it and getting reimbursement?
There is no allegations, no scintilla of an even hint of a suggestion that these were medically unnecessary products, or that these key opinion leaders, who we can presume were experienced endocrinologists who treat diabetes patients regularly, were even used the Eversense device. There's not, they don't actually have a name of a patient or a circumstance in which, with one sole exception, which is they suggest that that there was occasion when an Eversense device failed, and the company then, presumably, we can assume under a warranty claim, although it's not stated there, had to pay to have the device replaced, presumably because it wasn't covered by any insurance whatsoever, including obviously not a federal insurance. And I think the most fundamental thing, the one takeaway here, is the complaint, and I think the court is already is catching this, it fails to allege a scheme to defraud, but it throws a lot of information out there and around, and most of that information either is conclusory, so it uses the term sham, but there is no actual, the particularized details around this that actually give rise to a conclusion of sham, that is a conclusory characterization. What is sort of the dagger and is the easiest thing to conceptualize in this case as to why this court should affirm it is simply the CPT codes. It's important to recognize that the CPT codes here are, as Judge, you noted, are general. But most importantly about the CPT codes, they are, there is not one allegation that those service codes for continuous glucose monitoring devices were ever used in connection with Eversense. The only place where that is alleged is in the reply brief, not in the amended complaint.
They don't. They said the amended complaints was there was no other product that could fit that code at the time.
That's not true, that's not alleged, right? What is alleged in the complaint is it's a generalized code that applies to any continuous glucose monitoring devices, and what is imported through judicial notice by reference to a CMS manual is that the is a predominant device mentioned by CMS in 2019 that it did cover and did pay for by a competitor named Dexcom, which is a continuous glucose monitoring device. What the rhetoric around the world's only, it remains hanging out there and obviously not beyond this, but obviously sales rhetoric we can take for what it's worth. What is clear is this. The complaint, the amended complaint simply does not allege anywhere that Dr. B, Dr. W, Dr. BB ever used Eversense and served a patient using that code. It's not even on information and belief. And so what we're left with in this case is simply an argument that is based on complete and pure speculation, that a temporal proximity, as the magistrate judge found, that a general temporal proximity between these three doctors, where there were no details pled around them, were paid in 2019, and the use of this service code increased in 2019. But that is pure speculation. And it certainly is not the reliable indicia that gives rise to the strong inference.
Even without accepting that's true, the question ultimately is whether the federal treasury was corrupted. That's what the Quick Hem action is, and that is that ultimately that the government paid out money that was based on fraud. That's what it comes down to. Right.
And of course, Judge, you know what you wrote and held in the Grubbs case, in terms of that two-prong test that's required. The point I'm making about the CPT codes is they can't show, and they don't even allege that there was any claim related to the Eversense device. And given that, that's certainly not the reliable indicia this court has recognized in Grubbs that gives rise to a strong inference of federal claims here. On the federal claims side, the relator's complaint also mentions, and relator's counsel mentioned in his argument and may mention in rebuttal, TRICARE and the VA. There are no allegations that tie TRICARE and VA back to Dr. B or Dr. W or Dr. BB. There are no other doctors identified whatsoever in the complaint other than those three. All that's talked about is the marketing to TRICARE and V patients, generally speaking. We don't know who they marketed to, whether they actually marketed to, when it occurred, what they said, what they didn't. And as I noted, obviously identifying doctors who have diabetes patients and might have use for this device is what companies logically do. Otherwise, because it's a medically necessary product and it ought to be used in situations that are medically necessary. So I think what, as I stand here today and in looking at the briefs, I think it's essentially the Relators Council who was asking this court to change the Grubb standard. He's essentially asking this court to relax it and to suggest that this thin temporal proximity that he is relying on is enough to show federal claims. And he's asking the court on the fraudulent scheme side to take what are essentially three general in total payments for the period of 2019 without further detail and description about what the speaker's engagements for. He mentions Las Vegas. He doesn't talk about where in Las Vegas. He doesn't talk about the location or circumstances that would give rise to an inappropriate situation. I'm sure there are inappropriate situations in Las Vegas. I think we don't have to take judicial notice of it, but you've got to plead it. You've got to allege something more than simply that he spoke to people in Las Vegas. Likewise, he mentions dinners and at fancy steakhouses. Well, there are no allegations of a dinner with any detail. There is one allegation that mentions a nurse who was taken to, quote, a steakhouse. The complaint does not even say that the nurse's meal was paid for by Senseonics. It doesn't characterize the meal itself. It doesn't characterize what was said or not said at the meal. It's simply so that the characterization of the dinners is wildly beyond what the amended complaint actually has in it. With regard, you asked the question about intent, Judge Smith. Paragraph 70.
Scienter is what I was.
Excuse me, scienter, yes, sir. The paragraph 70 is an admonition saying that the company does not seek to do that. So it's not clear to me how that could possibly give rise to an inference of scienter.
Well, it would be an indication that if the company were to do otherwise, that it would be unlawful. If you're telling people what is lawful and what isn't lawful, then the implication of that is that if they do the wrong thing, it's unlawful, and that would be scienter.
Right, and so you've got to have more than just simply a denial, a recognition that we don't want to do what would break the law, in order to make an amended complaint survive a motion to dismiss.
Strikes me that this is a product that you either need or you don't need. It's not persuading people to take products. It's not selling a product that if you start to take an opioid, stated another way, the glucose monitoring code is needed by the diabetic. And so that regardless of how they end up, where they buy it and purchase it, ultimately, the claim, there's no dollars coming out of the federal treasury, and so whatever that to me strikes me as a kind of an odd way to characterize the QUTEM suit.
Well, in full agreement, Your Honor, the CPT codes here.
I'm not surprised you are.
Yeah, I mean the CPT codes here are so general, and basically therefore the fact that doctors used that code to potentially interpret data from some glucose monitoring product in years when Eversense was not eligible, obviously is, it may be true, but it does not link to the Eversense device, and it does not provide the reliable indicia that gives rise to the strong inference that this court requires. And frankly, I think it also defies the logic of the situation that existed in 2019. As this court has made very clear, the facts and circumstances matter, and this is the early stages of the development of a product and the commercialization of a product. And at that point in time, the product is coming into a marketplace that already has competition. The service codes are already being used on other continuous glucose monitoring devices. The key opinion leaders are already treating diabetic patients with other continuous glucose monitoring devices. And those devices that are recognized through the judicially noticed materials from CMS are coming online in 2019, in the 2018-2019, the period that we're talking about. So the fact that there would be increases in the use of certain CPT codes associated with servicing patients with continuous glucose monitoring devices is logical, but it's most logical and most plausible that it would relate to a competitor's device, not the Eversense device. And so that's the circumstances that we're confronted here. And because, obviously, the complaint is deficient, and because this relator is not asking on appeal to be allowed to replead, this court should rightly affirm.
All right, thank you, Mr. Richter.
Thank you.
Rosenthal for rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honors. Briefly, I just want to make sure that we level set here. We are talking about the complaint stage. We are talking about allegations that, and whether they give rise to a plausible inference of liability. The allegations have to be taken as true and have to be interpreted in a light favorable to the plaintiff. If counsel is correct about factual assertions that were made, then discovery will bear that out quickly, and discovery here would be targeted because the allegations are specific. They talk about particular individuals in a particular time period, targeting particular providers to induce referrals of a particular device from certain types of patients that have government payer insurance. There were a few statements that I do want to address. One, there was a statement that there's no allegation in the complaint about the Eversense CGM being the world's only long-term CGM system, but right in paragraph 6 of the complaint, it quotes Senseonics itself and cites to its own website saying Senseonics refers to the Eversense CGM system as, quote, the world's only long-term CGM system. So these allegations are in the complaint. He says there's no allegation that that these dinners were provided by Senseonics. But if we look at paragraph 81 of the complaint, we see Mr. Ramirez emailing his sales team talking about we need to get high potential clinicians to these dinners at the AACE conference, and we want high-value targets that will embrace Eversense. He talks about finding current subscribers but other big potential subscribers. These providers are being targeted to participate in these dinners because their potential to prescribe. Same thing with the speakers. There was a suggestion that speakers are being targeted because of their credentials or their experience. But that's baloney. We don't see any of that in the documents, and we don't see that in the complaint. What we see is that speakers are targeted based on their potential as clinicians to prescribe Eversense. They're not targeted because of their standing in the community. In fact, as counsel mentioned, one of the people that was taken to dinner was a nurse named Joe. He's not necessarily an influential member of the community, of the medical community. There's no indication that he was targeted because of that. He was targeted because he was in a position to refer patients for Eversense. Counsel made the argument that we don't have a direct line between referrals that were made and remuneration that was paid, but that direct line is exactly where Grubbs differs from the minority view that came out of the 11th Circuit that Grubbs expressly rejects. That view requires direct allegations of claims that were actually submitted and demands that there be direct allegations that connect the remuneration to particular claims. The Grubbs standard only requires that inferences be drawn. Dots can be put out there and lines can be drawn that are reasonably connected. That is what an inference is. And here, it is a very reasonable inference to make that when Senseonics sets out and targets providers based on their potential to prescribe, monitors the requisitions of providers, engages in further efforts to provide remuneration when those requisitions drop, when they do all of those things, and then we see that after they've provided those benefits, the use of codes that would be associated with the defendant's device skyrocket, it is a reasonable inference to draw that those claims are associated with Senseonics' device. Counsel made the argument that it's more plausible in his view that this related to other devices. Well, I would disagree with that. I would say that it's most plausible that the doctors who are being paid tens of thousands of dollars and fed it around the country by Senseonics are in fact prescribing Senseonics. But ultimately the question is irrelevant because the court is not at the complaint stage in the position to weigh what is more or less probable. The question is simply whether the allegations are plausible. And if the allegations are plausible, as the district court conceded they are, then the complaint goes forward. We get to discovery. And if it turns out that all of these requisitions were in fact for another device, discovery will reveal that in short order. The pond, as Grubb says, will either be stocked or barren, and we'll find that out quickly. And a motion for summary judgment can follow. In fact, if it turns out that they weren't requisitioning the device, I imagine we wouldn't even pursue the case further. But I suspect strongly, and I think it's reasonable to think, and certainly plausible, that we will find that these requisitions and this increase in claims did relate to the Eversense CGM. That's why these doctors were being targeted. That's why their requisitions were being monitored. That's why they continued to be engaged by Senseonics. Are there any further questions?
All right. Thank you, Mr. Rosenthal. Your case is under submission. The court will take a brief recess.